Hello, and welcome to the American Marketing Association's Marketing Power Podcast on Consumerology, the Market Research Myth. I'm your host, Nancy Picala, Director of Online Content for the AMA. We're very excited to welcome today our special guest, Philip Graves, to the program. Philip Graves is author of the book, Consumerology, the Market Research Myth, the Truth About Consumers, and the Psychology of Shopping, which was named one of Amazon's top 10 best business books of 2010. He's a consumer behavior consultant, author, speaker, and regular contributor to the media. For the last 5 years, he's been working with international businesses, providing expert advice on consumer behavior and behavioral insight. Alongside his own consumer behavior consultancy work for clients including the media, retailers, and financial services companies, Philip is an associate of Frontier Economics. Based in Cambridge, his work has taken him around the world, including the United States, Brazil, Singapore, and Japan. And if you want to know what Philip is up to, read his latest blog post at philipgraves.net/discussions or find him on LinkedIn. Philip, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Nancy. Nice to meet you.
Right. Well, Philip, your book certainly has set tongues wagging in the market research community since it was published about your assertion that research surveys will soon be history. Specifically, you state that, in quote, in 20 or 30 years, we will look back with genuine embarrassment at what we currently do. We'll look back on this period of market research where we've been seduced by this illusion that we can ask people what they think and learn from it, and we'll try to erase it from history. That's a pretty powerful statement, and I'm wondering if you can expound on what you meant and what that will mean to the market research community.
Sure. Well, I guess over the last 50 years or so, we've seen a massively increasing amount of market research, and the vast majority of that, whilst there are new techniques coming in all the time, still very much focuses on the idea that I can ask somebody what they think and that what they tell me will be fundamentally true and useful as an insight. Now, you get into degrees of the extent to which, you know, something is interpreted in a qualitative setting, or whether or not it's a quantitative questionnaire where an answer is taken directly and then a picture drawn from the statistics. But there is a fundamental problem with those approaches, and that is something that I talk about sometimes as the mind gap, and that is that our unconscious mind is far more involved in our behavior as consumers than we realize, and we have no direct access to that through our conscious mind. So we've got an awful lot of evidence coming out of behavioral economics and psychology and neuroscience that shows that people are really not very good witnesses to their own behavior. And the amount that, you know, detail that we go into asking them questions doesn't really overcome that fundamental problem. And in fact, it's compounded by the fact that the unconscious mind is very heavily influenced by the things that market research does. So they in turn produce a response, but all of this has very little to do with what's really going on in people's minds when they are existing as consumers.
Yeah, you sort of provide the premise that you think research is intrinsically flawed because people, as you said, aren't very good at describing why they do what they do or at predicting their future behaviors. Instead, you suggest the key is to understanding consumer behavior by observing their behavior in context. Do you think that's true of all product categories, and is this truly doable?
It's sometimes very difficult to do, and I provide in the book a framework for looking at the degrees of validity that you might be able to get to in terms of what I call psychological confidence in the research that you're conducting, which I think is far more fundamentally important than statistical confidence. Not that I have any problem with statistical confidence, but that comes much later in the process. So I think that fundamentally behavior is truth. So if you covertly see somebody doing something, or if you have sales data, if you have data which is based on what consumers have actually done, it is a useful factual reference point. And it's a much better place to start from, and it's very important to understand the factual basis of that than it is to go and look at survey data that's based on what people have said, but which of course very often in businesses takes on a validity of its own because it comes out as a number. It feels solid. It feels like a statistic. It feels like a number. It feels tangible. But in fact, the basis for that number is a set of mental processes that we really shouldn't be depending on to inform our business decision making.
You know, it's argued that part of what an effective market researcher does is to really understand what the right questions are to ask and the way in which to ask them in order to get those insights out of consumers. Could it be that there are just a lot of bad surveys out there, thanks in part to not only some deep cuts in research budgets over the last few years, but also this plethora of do-it-yourself survey tools, some which are better than others, that are now available?
Well, that's undoubtedly true. There's an awful lot of bad research. But I think it's an excuse that the market research community leans on too readily when market research ends up being proven to be flawed. And, you know, in the passage of time, we learned that the results were not valid and that somebody launches the product and it goes on to be successful or you know, when market research said it wouldn't be or else they don't launch it and, you know, they live to regret it because somebody else brings out the idea and that subsequently is successful or whatever the benchmark may be. But the reality is that, you know, it's to do with the way people's brains work. And once you look at what psychology is demonstrating, and this isn't a matter of opinion, it's a matter of, you know, empirical, demonstrable, scientific fact, people, you know, there is no good question very often. You know, in most cases, the question is not a good route to understand what's going on in the brain. And so the idea that a skilled researcher can design a question, for example, that will gauge whether or not someone will like a new product, when that assessment is taking place out of the context in which it will be responded to and where the focalism that's introducing is entirely artificial, it's fanciful. There is no good question to do that.
You know, I thought one of the fascinating parts of your book were all the great anecdotes and case study information you put about, you know, market research failures that sort of support your position. And you cite a number of them. You know, you talk about some case studies with Nike and Heineken and a few others. But one of the ones that I thought was fascinating was Red Bull, which is apparently sold more than 3 billion cans of their drink by 2006, yet researchers concluded, according to your book, that after some pretty rigorous testing, no other products had ever performed so poorly in consumer testing. So are these examples that you have cited, you think, exceptions to the rule, or are there just as many instances, if not more, where market research has actually done the opposite of this and drove solid products and business decisions? Or do you have a situation sort of, you know, the rule and not the exception?
Well, I think this is a really interesting area because, and there are lots of ways to answer this. So to take one example, you know, if you read your horoscope, it's going to be right some of the time. You know, it just is because of chance. And so it's, from a scientific point of view, it's not acceptable to say that, well, market research has worked in this instance, therefore market research works per se. By the same token, you know, it wouldn't be reasonable to take one example of when market research hasn't worked and to say, therefore, market research doesn't work at all. But I think what is interesting is to look behind those accounts when market research has quite clearly failed. And bear in mind that for the most part, it's generally not in people's interests to report when market research doesn't work. And we might feel that there are, you know, a handful of fairly well-known case studies out there. I've certainly uncovered a number of others during my research for the book. But generally speaking, a lot of research that is wrong kills off an idea before it gets to market, so no one ever hears about it. We never get to find out, if you like, whether it was right or wrong. Yeah. And other research kind of gets pushed to one side because people do something else or something else happens and they discount it in their minds. So I think that there is much to be learned by looking in detail psychologically at why those occasions where we know research was wide of the mark, it was wide of the mark. And what you find when you look at those examples is the reasons are not to do with some nuance of research. So, for example, you know, oh, the sample might not have been right, or, you know, then they could have phrased the question better. It's something much more fundamental than that. And in the case of Red Bull, you know, it was to do with a whole lot of contextual associations that that drove that brand, that created a position for it where it didn't matter that it didn't taste brilliant. And it, you know, long since has not mattered that, that Red Bull, you know, looked at in isolation is perhaps not the most wonderful drink. But of course, there will be people who drink it and tell themselves they like it. And they will genuinely believe that they like it. But that's because of the way the brain works and the fact that it takes in and factors in all this contextual information when it is reaching a verdict on something that it experiences. And if you look to psychology, there's a great experiment done in British Columbia, known as the Love on the Bridge experiment, where people asked a researcher out, an attractive female researcher out, these male students, on the basis they thought that they liked her and found her attractive. But they know from the way the experiment was designed that it was because they were put into a position on a precarious bridge where the anxiety, the adrenaline, the edginess that they were feeling because of the context they were in was misattributed to the girl, and far more who were on the wobbly bridge asked the girl out for a date than did in the control condition. So the stories we tell ourselves about why we like things and the way we like to post-rationalize it, and for example, somebody saying now that Red Bull's a massive brand, that they love the taste, you know, it's far from a simple picture. And market research taste testing, of course, creates this very artificial focus. It strips things away from their context, sometimes even takes branding out. And as a result of that, just ends up with obtaining a completely arbitrary reading on people's response to this this product.
And, you know, let me ask you, in addition to this very significant issue of how consumers actually, you know, behave with research, are there reasons associated with how the research industry itself is organized in the way we commission research or, you know, we pursue research as a whole that is contributing to what you see as ineffective research models right now?
Well, I think the problem, I understand your question and there are aspects of that, but I think the problems are much, much, much more fundamental. And it's revealing, I think, that if you look at the most powerful counter arguments, my argument is often put forward, powerful in terms of the vehemence rather than necessarily intellectual validity, is, oh, but lots of people do, there's so much market research done that it's going on so often, it must work. Well, people have a long track record of believing in things because it suits them to believe in it. And then it's, you know, a lot of the reasons that explain why consumers do particular things are evidence in why people buy market research. And, you know, the reasons are fundamental to our desire to minimize risk, to believe that there is a way of, to some extent, getting more reassurance about a decision because we feel comfortable that we've got that reassurance, irrespective of whether the reassurance is genuine or not. And so whilst, yes, you can look at it and say that the boom in online surveys is bad news because all the questions involve priming, or for the most part they involve priming respondents, and the mindset is about as far removed very often from the mindset that someone would be in as a consumer, those are relatively incidental problems because they imply that by taking away that problem and having an open-ended question, and asking it in the street, that you're somehow better off, but you just then throw up a whole set of other influencing biases and distortions and focalism and priming, and you've got a whole other set of issues. So whilst there are a lot of people with a vested interest in saying that the solution is a particular form of research, of asking questions and a particular approach to doing it, if you look at the psychology, if you look at the evidence, they all are beset with their own problems, and really the solution lies elsewhere.
And let me also ask you, you spent some time discussing how the traditional survey or questionnaire tool is not, you know, very effective, but what about other tools in the researcher's toolbox, such as online panels and MROCs that more and more researchers are using?
Well, and this, I think, plays to the heart of, again, broad consumer trends. What are we interested in? We're interested in convenience and utility over quality very often. And a lot of the research techniques that have come to the fore, like panels, like online surveys, they provide what I classify as convenient consensus. And people are happy to take that quick read, that view, the fact they get an answer out, and let it influence their own decision making and factor it into their decision making, feel good about it. But really, if they looked at the precarious nature of that, of those numbers, of the data that's coming out of those surveys, they really would do well to feel a lot less certain about the information they're getting. I mean, when I was writing the book, I reached a point where I was looking for an example to include. I'd reached that point where I thought, no, it'd be good to give an example. I turned to the newspaper, and I guarantee this is absolutely true. And on that day, in the Daily Telegraph in the UK, there was a story about a survey that the BBC had commissioned to look at a part of the BBC license fee and what was going to happen for it. And I pulled it apart and I said, look, here are all the issues with this survey. Lots of reasons why the answer that's come out of this should not be trusted. And then 3 or 4 days later, there was another survey on exactly the same issue that had been commissioned by the UK government. And they'd gone about it a different way. The difference in the ultimate conclusion they made was 60 percentage points.
Wow.
Now, that, statistical confidence would have put an answer in a bracket, because there were fairly large samples, of probably about 4 or 5 percentage points on that number. And this was a difference between 6 and 66%. Now, anybody could look at that and say, oh, yeah, there'll be a bit of self-interest in there, but they were conducted by large polling companies who said, we've piloted these questionnaires, we've looked at them, we believe these are an accurate representation of something, of the issue. But that just demonstrates the extent to which people are influenced by all sorts of nuances of questioning. And the actual answer is, what was the real answer? Well, we'll never know. There isn't one, because as soon as people started asking the question, it was entirely artificial.
In your book, you also discussed the AFECT approach, that's A-F-E-C-T approach, as a way of evaluating the reliability of consumer insight. I was wondering if you could explain this approach to our listeners and how it works.
Well, as I was coming towards the end of the book, I realized that, I'm pragmatic enough to know that it's going to take some time for organizations, although there are some who are already doing it, to sort of acknowledge the frailties of market research. And that I thought what would be helpful for them and for researchers would be to put together a framework that would enable people to either look at an existing piece of consumer insight, or when they're putting together a study or commissioning a study, to find something out about consumers, to have some framework to look at the psychological validity of the answers they're getting. Because at the moment, as I've said before, all this data tends to take on a life of its own. Once the survey's over, it goes into the boardroom, it goes out to the executives, and it tends to be treated as fact. And with the effect criteria, it's an acronym for 5 elements that you need to consider to decide how reliable this data is likely to be. The A is it's an analysis of behavior. Ultimately, behavioral data is the best place to be. There's some behavioral data is better than others, and that's to do with whether or not it was kind of covertly observed, or whether people are trying to recall their own behavior out of context, for instance. Then you get further problems because people's memory is contextual. So the A is an analysis of behavior. The F, what frame of mind are people in when they are responding to whatever the issue is, because we are capable of reacting entirely differently, the same person, if we are in a different frame of mind. If the reason we'll go on holiday somewhere, bring back the sombrero and think it's the best thing in the world, and then within a couple of weeks of having it back in our apartment, we can't really quite work out why we bought it. When we bought it at the time, we were convinced, and it's because our frame of mind is different. And linked to that, the E is the environment. We know that human beings are hugely influenced by environmental factors, massively influenced by them, and massively influenced by them at an unconscious level. So you can change something in the environment that people would never believe would influence what they buy, like the background music or a very faint smell. and it can affect how they respond to products and what they ultimately buy. So is the environment present when this research is going on is a hugely significant factor. Is it covert? Focalism is a massive problem. As soon as I direct your attention to something, I'm likely to be causing you to consider it at a conscious level, and therefore the read I'm going to get is going to be a byproduct of probably the wrong part of your brain. It depends a little bit what the issue is, but 9 times out of 10 it'll be the wrong part of your brain. And the last one is time frame. If you have a product, for example, a fast-moving consumer good product that people routinely buy, they walk along the aisle, they pick it up in a blink of an eye, put it straight in their basket or in their trolley, then it makes no sense at all to spend 90 minutes analyzing that purchase or discussing that purchase with them in a focus group, say. Not that there aren't a whole host of other reasons ever to use focus groups, but the amount of time that they interact with that product will reflect to a large degree the mental processes that are behind their involvement with it. And as soon as you start to move away from that time frame, then the chances are you're moving away from reality. So by looking at those 5 criteria, you can look at any piece of research, any piece of customer insight work, and say, well, how confident can I be when I'm making my decision that this is good data on which to make that judgment? The extreme case, and I've had this recently, a client, financial services client, did 20 focus groups. I got involved in the project. In fact, one of the people involved was on the client side, was reading my book, and he realized he couldn't trust the thing he was hearing. And as it turned out, he was absolutely right to believe that. And so, although it was a painful financial decision, they abandoned those 20 focus groups. Now, they invited me along to be debriefed and said, look, is there anything we can get out of this project that we've just spent £40,000 or so on? And frankly, there was very little, because on an effect basis, there was nothing there really that we could have any confidence in. And we then developed an alternative approach, and the project was driven forward in a different basis and in a way that he was much more comfortable with and that fitted his intuitive feeling about the right direction for what they were doing in terms of the evidence and where he knew the validity of the read he was getting. Now, we weren't able to get, because it was a new product, we weren't able to get a kind of perfectly valid, psychologically valid approach. But we could look at elements of it and say, well, we can test this. I can't tell you whether this is going to be a success, but I can tell you that out of these options, this one is more attractive in this particular context, and so on. And out of that approach, he was able to delineate where he needed to make a decision and where research data wasn't going to be able to help him, to where it might give him some clues, but he still needed to factor it in with his judgment and other organizational issues. As a result of that, they ended up in a position that they were much more comfortable with. Had they taken the original research at face value and trusted it as being valid, they would have ended up in a completely different place, and it would have been a disaster for the business.
Yeah, that sounds like a great formula to look at the reliability of consumer behavior, and it makes a lot of sense. Just a couple last questions. I came across an interesting quote from our favorite music mogul and idol maker, Simon Cowell, who has said that he thinks research kills creativity in general. I'm wondering what your take is on that. Do you think research really is the enemy of creativity?
It's common for these debates to kind of get pulled into kind of a dichotomy, and things are polarized as being one thing or the other, and inevitably often the situation is a bit more complex than that. But if you were asked me for a short answer, I would say yes, research is an absolute killer of creativity. The problem again comes down to consensus. I have no issue at all with any amount of talking to consumers, of going out and getting to know them, of even putting them together and listening to them talk to each other. You know, those are all fine. Where it goes wrong is when you allow the prevailing view, the consensus view, to take on some degree of validity that doesn't pay attention to the process that formed it and the problems inherent in that process that formed it. So, for example, if I'm an advertising creative And I get together a bunch of consumers and we talk about this beer for an hour or so. And one of them says something that connects to my associations, to my vision, to my understanding, to my expertise about how to communicate a product, to how to bring it to life. And I make some connection like that. I mean, that's the sort of thing that entrepreneurs do all the time, that creative people do all the time. That's absolutely fine. But the point where research starts to kill creativity is when it takes something out of context, puts it in front of a group of consumers, and then takes the response it gets back as some kind of objective measure of reality, when for all the reasons we've discussed to do with context and environment and framing and priming, it will be nothing of the sort. I think the vast majority of times when research gets involved in creativity, it's at the wrong point in the process. I think, you know, gleaning things from consumers is absolutely fine, but there is not an objectively measurable process for gauging creativity, and too often research is, again, for understandable reasons, it's trying to provide safeguards, it's trying to reassure, it's trying to help make executives feel better about decisions they've got to make. But really, you look at some of the examples of very, very successful products and campaigns that were launched despite what research said, and you, I think, fairly quickly appreciate that there is just as big a risk of research killing off a good idea as there is of it approving one. And personally, I would want a more reliable and valid barometer to take forward when I was developing creative ideas. And the one that I'd want to refine and work on is my own judgment. And you will only get that when you accept that you've made a decision, you've made it as well as you can, and then you take the step and stand back and learn from it. And unfortunately, when you put research into that process, it brings in with it a false piece of information very often, but one to which weight is attached. So later on, when the product initiative has failed, everyone goes, well, we tested it and it didn't work. So people said it would work, then it seemed not to. Well, we don't really know what happened there. Perhaps it was a problem with the sales reps or somewhere else or somewhere else. And as a result of that, it makes it very hard for organizations to learn from their own mistakes.
Well, you know, it seems to me that in your book you're really calling for a sort of a fundamental shift in how we look at consumer behavior and market research in general. So where does the market research industry go from here in your view?
My view is that the market research industry is going to come under increasing scrutiny. And it's interesting to me that for a business discipline that is so involved in metrics and measurement and analysis, it really has not done a very good job of analyzing itself and its own approaches and its own value in terms of what it brings to businesses. So I think it's going to come under increasing scrutiny, both from businesses who my view is everybody is pretty much a research skeptic. There are times when it suits them to believe what research is telling them, but there are other times when they look back and there will have been research conclusions that they decided to push to one side or to ignore to some extent or other. And I think that, you know, as is the case with most sort of faith-based belief systems, that, you know, you tend to find that they get chipped away at, and, you know, that a movement starts to build where people start to become more skeptical of them. And I think that that's what will happen. I think that academics will increasingly focus on the value and on the benefits of alternative approaches. And what we'll see from market research companies is a lot of scrabbling around to bring in new techniques, to propose that they've got a new way of doing things. And to some extent, that's been going on for the last 10 or 20 years or so. But again, it feels to me a little bit like smoke and mirrors. It's more of the same, and it doesn't address the fundamental issues. But it kind of keeps people's eye off the real problem and the real issues, which are very often that companies are sitting there with a brand tracker that's never correlated very well with their sales figures, or with a customer experience monitor that doesn't seem to link to actual levels of loyalty and repurchase and so on. And so I think that, you know, increasingly skepticism will be brought to the fore, healthy skepticism, and companies will start to realize that they have more to gain by by reviewing their approach to market research. And if you look at some of those companies that that have got a very different stance on market research, you know, they are conspicuous by their success at the moment.
Well, that's a very, very good point. And these have really been really fascinating insights about a new way of looking at consumer behavior and market research, and we've been talking to Philip Graves. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for listening to this edition of our AMA podcast series. I hope it's been a good learning and listening experience, and you can look for information on other upcoming podcasts by visiting marketingpower.com/podcast, and make sure to sign up for the RSS feed on Marketing Power so you're aware of all the podcast series available to you. And for information about the book, Consumerology, The Market Research Myth, The Truth About Consumers, and The Psychology of Shopping by Philip Graves, and how to purchase a copy, visit the online AMA bookstore. Until next time, I've been your host, Nancy Pacala. Thank you for joining us.
Bye.